Well, it's probably still, it's too early for runners to start carb loading for this Sunday's Capital City River Run. I guess you load up the day before, if I remember correctly. But the fifth third Capital City River Run includes a marathon, a half marathon, a 5K, and a relay, all family-friendly events, according to the event's website. It goes to benefit the Impression 5 Science Center, and I didn't have time to check the weather here for Sunday before I came on. Hopefully that's good. Runners endure all kinds of weather, right? The race starts and finishes on Grand Avenue in front of LCC, and there's a party afterwards featuring the Lansing Brewing Company at Addato Park. That is this Sunday, the 5th-3rd Capital City River Run. Break a leg. It's current state here on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. I open up the program today with a list. The Stadium District, the Lofts on Washington Square, the Lansing Brewing Company, Easttown, Marketplace, Avenue Flats, the Outfield. For more than 20 years, our first guests have launched these and dozens of other residential and corporate development projects in and around Lansing. Pat and Scott Gillespie and their respective companies, the Gillespie Group and the Gillespie Company, are almost continually building or rebuilding parts of the Lansing area. Bob Trezise, CEO of the Lansing Economic Area Partnership, LEAP, say the Gillespies helped transform a woe-is-us self-esteem problem in our city into an attitude of anything is possible. To talk about their work and various related topics, we welcome Pat and Scott Gillespie to Current State. Good to see you.
Morning, Mark.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you for being here. Both MSU grads, right?
Absolutely.
Yes.
Yeah.
Construction management?
Construction management.
For both of you?
Yes.
Yeah. I want to ask each of you about how many launched projects you have going on right now everywhere, because I know you work out occasionally, you work outside of Michigan. Between how many do you have going on right now, Pat?
I believe we have about four in the planning process or construction process right
okay.
now.
Okay. Scott?
We have two underway and two more that are in the planning.
And how many of those are in Greater Lansing, or in or near Lansing?
Three of those four.
Okay.
All of my four.
Okay. Update us on the projects that are on your short lists right now. Scott, is that Easttown Flats, Michigan Avenue, basically?
Easttown and the 2000 block of Michigan Avenue is starting actually today and tomorrow.
Okay.
We started with demolition a few weeks ago, and we'll start with foundations here in earnest next week.
And remind us what's on the 2000th block of Michigan Avenue that people will remember and what you have planned for there.
The 2000 block of East Michigan is the historic commercial core of the east side of Lansing. It used to house Amel's Restaurant, which was there for many, many years. There's a karate dojo that's been there for 40 years. We have removed six buildings, and we're building a four-story mixed-use building, about 12,000 square feet of commercial space, and 37 new apartments.
Are the neighbors, is the community in that neighborhood excited about this? I think anytime you plan a project that big, you know, as Mayor Bernero says, people don't like change, you know. Are the neighbors, is the neighborhood excited about what you're doing?
You know, Mark, what we do, we take a strong focus on the community. We held a series of meetings and one large community forum to get their input. We made significant changes to the building design to gain their support and to hear from them. We listened, we changed the design, and since that time, we've had just an overwhelming supportive group from the community, and we're happy that we've done that.
Mm-hmm. Pat, what's at the top of your short list right now?
In about 60 days, we hope to start Marketplace Apartments, which is another phase along the river. Another 90 units, and that'll have a bar-restaurant attached within it along the river. The Clara's restaurant, we're going to reboot that, starting probably in November, December, hoping for a spring opening. We have a new corporate headquarters we're working with for downtown that we're optimistic on. And then we got another...
Can you name the company?
We cannot.
Okay.
But it's looking promising.
Understood.
It's a high-tech company. They're not currently located here. And then we have another... retail / manufacturer across from the brewery that we should be able to announce in the next 60 days. So,
what's most rewarding about this work for you, Scott?
You know, there's a lot of rewards to it. I guess, you know, one of our focuses is having a positive impact on a community in an area. and building something that's innovative, something that can benefit everybody. But one of the things in building apartments that has always been heartwarming to me is knowing that it's somebody's home, that that's where they celebrate holidays, that's where they celebrate birthdays, that's where they raise their children. So when you're building somebody's home, I take a lot of pride.
Anything you'd add to that, Pat?
No, he hit it right on the head. It's just community pride and people maybe holding their chest a little higher and their head a little higher when they drive by their community and see positive things going on.
I can't imagine what it's like to finish a project. I mean, there's so much. You guys think years out, you know, you're constantly looking quite a ways into the future. I can't imagine after working years on a project what it's like to actually open the door, let people in, especially when you're talking about homes or apartments or lofts or whatever. What's most challenging about this work?
I think right now the most challenging part is the approval process. A lot of the sites that we work with are environmentally contaminated, urban, so they have zoning restrictions, they have setback restrictions, and then you have, you know, height restrictions. So it's just getting through the process of, you know, that can take 2 to 3 years in some instances of planning, and that planning takes time, money, and expertise that, you know, you could spend 2 years on a project and have it not happen. So that's probably the most challenging, is the unknown, and the approval process is usually the unknown part.
Talk with us about working with municipal governments. Typically, for example, I mean, what's it like working with the city of Lansing on a project?
You know, there's a lot of support from the city. There's a lot of challenges as well. You know, as Pat was mentioning, some of the zoning challenges and, you know, the politics can get difficult. But at the same time, what we've done in the recent past is try to work with the community and try to show that we are that we're responsive and that we care and we're going to listen. So I think that's earned us some good favor. But it's there's a lot of rules, there's a lot of restrictions, and there's a lot of costs that go along with cleaning up an urban site.
What single person would you say, you got a project, you're working with the city on some public-private thing, I guess. Who is it you're in contact with the most? Is that Bob Trezise? Is that the mayor's office, a city councilor? Who is that?
It's Bob Trezise is the point person, and he seems to be able to navigate his way through the system and help get you in touch with who needs to get done. But, you know, Bob's been there a while, and he knows what's going on, so he seems to be our first point of contact, and his team, too. He's got a heck of a team.
Our guests are Pat and Scott Gillespie of the Gillespie Group and the Gillespie Company, respectively. Virge Bernero is perceived as having made a difference in Lansing, the open for business mayor. Is that perception accurate? Is that as deserved as it seems?
I believe it is. You know, he's very supportive. If you're doing things that match the vision of the city and their future plans, He knows what he wants, and he's supportive if there's some commonality.
More hoops to jump through in East Lansing. I think a casual observer might assume that there probably is.
I think there's definitely more hoops to jump through in East Lansing. It's a totally different community. It's a lot of upside in East Lansing, but it's definitely more challenging as you head east.
Does that get back to what you said about approvals, the approval process?
Yeah, the timing it takes in East Lansing is almost a deterrent in many instances to look at a project.
Mm-hmm. I feel obligated to ask about all the activity on Michigan on the Lansing-East Lansing line there, Red Cedar Renaissance and Skyview. Neither one is a project of yours, but are these, do you feel these are going to be as transformational as proponents have led everybody to believe?
I think the Red Cedar and the Skyview are going to be very transformational. The people they're going to bring on a daily basis, the bar restaurants they're going to bring, and the hotels, it's going to ripple effect in a massive way.
I couldn't agree more.
What do you think the future holds for the corner of Grand River and Abbott? I'd just like to get your thoughts on that, the old bank building and beyond. How do you move that forward? What would make most sense there?
I like the plan they have right now of a hotel I think they have hotel and living units and some retail. You need people living there after 5 o'clock. You need people living there on weekends. And then the hotel element brings a whole nother group of people that have disposable income to spend on, you know, the new retail that could go in. So mm-hmm. I like the plan they have proposed.
Mm-hmm. Pat, the residents of the outfield have seen their first lug nut season come and go. Has it been what you hoped?
Madly successful. I wish we would have done another floor. And we're being being contacted by other minor league teams around the country right now to come do more.
Well, and what about City Market? Is it gonna make it? It's faced its fair share of challenges here.
I think the City Market is going to take some transformation over the next 12 to 18 months. Our next phase at Marketplace, adding the bar restaurant there, and we hope to make some pretty massive improvements to the park along the riverfront there, make it more like a campus Martius park that's in Detroit that draws people for different events and happenings. So maybe that can be more of a hub, and the City Market could play a pretty major role in that.
It's a colorful spot. Have you gotten what's been the feedback to that? I imagine some people like it and some people don't, but.
You know what? We do get negative comments on the colors, but it really we don't advertise. People seem to know where, you know, hey, I want to live in that colorful building. So we get good and bad, but the people that are there seem to really like it.
You have to contend with the economy. You have to contend with city councils and mayors and economic development directors and realtors and what have you. Talk about the larger environment here for development. How does that environment change over time? You must go through good periods, maybe low interest rates, something like that, and then you go through rougher times. What's that environment like right now? It seems to be booming. It seems to be very good.
It is very good. It is very good. I think it starts, you know, with the economy. We're able to borrow money to build something and to create the visions that we have. But more so than that, we have support. And we have community support, and we have a changing, I don't want to say a changing local economy, but a growing local economy. And we have a push to retain the talent that's from Michigan State. We have a push towards urban development, which is all leading towards improvement of our streetscapes and sense of place and bringing people together.
When you get pushback, how do you deal with that?
Depends on who you're receiving pushback from, I guess. I think the biggest thing from my perspective is to listen. And we try to listen and we answer questions. A lot of times pushback is just, you know, as you mentioned, the resistance to change. And if you can listen and you can be genuine with that, I think you can work through a lot of the issues.
What percentage of your projects, Pat, are public-private? I mean, is that a significant number of them or fewer or what?
I would say about 50% of our developments have been public-private, but even when you have a private development, there's a public element. You have utilities, you have streets, you have some other part of the project that needs to be accessed from the public. So almost every project is a public-private because you have to go to the community and get it approved.
How did you both end up in development? Was this in the family or what?
No, our father was in the car industry, and for me, I always liked the tangible aspect of building a building. I liked being able to see the impact that it had on a surrounding area.
Yeah, but you both ended up with that. It's interesting to have a car dealer father and two of the sons end up in construction management. How did that happen?
He actually encouraged us not to go into cars and to go into something that we have a passion for. And I guess, my thought was always to, if I could own rental houses and help make a neighborhood better by fixing up houses that were an eyesore, that's how it started. And it kind of just grew into, boy, I can fix up bigger projects and bigger buildings and make an impact on a neighborhood.
Pat and Scott Gillespie are our guests here on Current State. Did either of you consider other careers ever? Or was this baked in the cake at an early phase?
I always thought an attorney or an accountant or something like that. But as I got older, I figured out that seemed pretty boring compared to what we do.
What about you, Scott?
You know, as a child, you know, I think a lot of boys want to do what their father does. I thought about architecture, but I couldn't spend 6 years in school. And I was very fortunate to know what I wanted to do, to know that I wanted to go into construction and development. Yeah.
You run different companies today, but you were together for about a decade. Did you figure you'd spend about enough time together growing up in the same house? And then, or how did that unfold?
Well, I think we both achieved a level of expertise where we looked at each other and said, we can do a lot more projects separate, and we each have unique ideas and creative ideas. And for each of us to run with that path, has been very rewarding to sit and cheerlead for Scott on the sideline. And I know he cheers for me, and to banter ideas back and forth. I think we can get more done in the community separate than we can together.
Do you ever find, though, that you're representing opposing interests in some way?
It's pretty rare. Pretty rare. I mean, we're both competitive people in a competitive industry. But I think it's, you know, as Pat was saying, we cheerlead for each other, stick up for each other. And we really haven't found ourselves on opposing sides. And, you know, I'd rather be a brother than I would an adversary.
Mm. I'm always struck by how much new housing has been created in recent years. And I sometimes wonder if we're not heading toward oversupply, toward a glut. Is there enough future demand to sustain everything that's out there and everything that's being planned?
Housing type is important. I think we're hitting a bubble in student housing around here. I think it's going up like crazy, and I think there's a lot more on the table. Some of the old product is really going to suffer, but I still think there's a huge demand for urban housing for millennials and empty nesters, and I guess we'll call it I don't know what generation we call it, age 40 to 50. But there's a market for that in the urban core, but I do think there's a bubble in student housing right now.
Well, Scott, what do you think?
I would agree. I think the new student housing is surpassing some of the older student housing and kind of forcing the older student housing to improve. I agree wholeheartedly with Pat that there's a market, and it's quite broad. You know, we can't just look at the millennials. We're actually actively working with some seniors and doing some work with them to figure out what they need and what they want.
Well, there's a glut of baby boomers demographically here whose lives are changing right now as we speak. There's all kinds of people. I mean, you hear of baby boomers moving to the city who have lived in the suburbs and things like that. So, Pat, you mentioned 40 to 50-year-olds as making up a big part of your market, though, too. Scott, what about you? Who makes up the market, as you see it, for a recently built or planned development here in 2016?
You know, as I mentioned, we're finding that it's very broad. We have tenants that are recent graduates that are working downtown or working in East Lansing. We have mature professionals. We have entrepreneurs. We have a growing number of empty nesters.
We have some people listening to this thinking, what is Bayshore doing talking to a couple of rich developers? Developers are only driven by profit. When you encounter that attitude, how do you respond, Pat?
Well, it's a natural. I mean, if you look on TV, from the TV shows and stuff, the developers are always portrayed as, you know, tearing down trees, against the environment, just want to make money. So it's a fair assessment. But when you look at some of the things, you got to look at a person's actions. And when you look and we've done a Marshall Street Armory building that we're really not making any money on. But you look at, the historic nature and reuse of the building and how it changed the neighborhood. You look at it and say, well, maybe that wasn't profit driven. It's a community minded building full of nonprofits that we're charging subsidized rent to, that the neighborhood uses, and it changed the park area. So you look at some of the actions and go, maybe that wasn't profit driven. Maybe there are other means to their madness.
Do you pay enough taxes?
We pay plenty of taxes.
Yes.
The last recession was a whopper, and I hesitate to say it, but another one will come someday. How do you plan for that? Can you plan for that?
It's hard to plan for it. And, I was lucky enough to start my business in 2006 is when we separated and I went my own way, which was just a mere, 24 months before everything really hit the fan. So we weathered the storm by not over-leveraging and not trying to do too much. I think it's, if you can go into these with a conservative nature and not try to bite off more than you can chew, I think you can weather it. But we don't know how bad the next recession is going to be.
Scott Gillespie, his company is the Gillespie Company. Pat Gillespie, his brother and a fellow Lansing native, runs the Gillespie Group. We've been talking about development here in Lansing, their history, and what they make of the current environment. Pat and Scott, thanks for being here today.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
Coming up on Current State, the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality is reviewing a permit renewal filed by the city of East Lansing to allow it to dump treated water into the Red Cedar River. Problem is, that permit expired more than 4 years ago.
Back in 2012, the city applied for a permit renewal on time, so why is the state only now getting around to it? We'll look for answers coming up on Current State. It's Current State on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Fans of the network TV show Whose Line Is It Anyway know its premise. Four comic masters riffing off each other's improvised lines in zany high-speed fun. The program originally debuted in Britain more than 25 years ago. The U.S. version of the show ran from 1998 to 2007 on ABC, Whose Line was revived in 2013 on the CW. Now, the show, which is taped before a live audience, has also spawned a live stage production. Tonight, comedians Joel Murray, Jeff B. Davis, Ryan Stiles, and Greg Proops bring the antics to the Wharton Center in East Lansing with their rendition of Who's Live Anyway. I caught up with Greg Proops this week before his performance, and I asked him why he chose to become a comedian in the first place.
Well, I don't have any other marketable skills, Mark. As a teenager, I started doing it. Otherwise, I would have been a petty criminal. Because I don't even know how to type, really. And I was treated as an adult when I first started doing stand-up by the people at the nightclubs, and I think that's what really appealed to me, being given that kind of respect when you're a teenager.
Whose Line Is It is actually an import from British television. The program began back in 89. How did you get involved?
They were auditioning people, and I was trapped in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, doing a gig. And a friend called me and said, there's a British improv show. Then I didn't get to audition that year, and I wept bitter tears in my room. Fortunately, they came back the next year, and I lived in San Francisco at the time, and they auditioned, and I got on. And that was 1989, and it's been quite a long time now. Mm. And I did the British show for 10 years, and then the ABC show for 4 years, and now we're on our fourth year on the CW. So it's been pretty wild. We also did the West End in London in July. We played the Palladium.
Nice.
For a couple of weeks, and we did it last year as well at the West End. So it's as popular as it's ever been, as far as I can tell.
That's outstanding. How does perfecting a stand-up routine impact your ability to improvise? It would seem like it gives your improvisational muscles maybe a little bit of a rest, and that might be a good thing. Do you go back and forth kind of from one to the other?
I do. I do stand-up. I have a podcast called The Smartest Man in the World. And I have, and I do the improv with the guys, and it's all builds into one thing, you know what I mean? Because I like to play and go off the top of my head and jump backwards, not looking where I'm going, it makes it fun for me because it keeps it exciting all the time. Stand up is a different bag because you have to write things out and be very specific about what you're talking about.
Right.
And the podcast is a combination of both. I can go off a paper and talk about current events and things like that, and I also extemporize as much as possible. So everything I do kind of plays into each other. With the improv group, though, we really are riffing it as hard as we can, and we do amuse each other quite a lot at this late date, which is very nice.
How unscripted is Whose Line Is It?
Completely.
Yeah.
We know what games we're going to play, and we know what we're going to do, but that's it. We don't know what we're going to say, and I don't know how much plainer that could be that we're improvising. If you don't know what you're about to say, then you're making it up. And, of course, I'm in a group with Ryan Stiles, who's, it's like, you know, playing hockey with Wayne Gretzky. He just points at the net and puts the biscuit in the basket.
Gotcha. Do you have any sense as to how a skit's going to go before the show is taped?
Oh, no. I mean, I think everything, you know, is on its own merits. But, I mean, mind you, when we're taping the show, I'm there with Colin Mockery and Wayne Brady, so I've got a pretty good idea it's going to be funny because these guys don't really fail that much.
Yeah.
And so I ended up on a very strong team, which has been lucky for me. And the same with our live show. You know, Joel Murray, who's, of course, of the famous Murray clan of Bill and Brian, and Jeff Davis, who's we've worked with for years, and who's also on Whose Line. We've all done improv a long time, so we really hit the stage hard and try to be really enthusiastic and throw the ball at each other as hard as possible.
We're talking with Greg Proops. He's a stand-up comedian and improvisational artist. He's done extensive voiceover work as well in a number of films and TV shows. He's probably best known as a semi-regular cast member on the TV show Whose Line Is It Anyway? Greg will perform tonight at the Wharton Center on the MSU campus in East Lansing as part of the traveling production Whose Live anyway. We've got a clip here from the show that I'd like to play just to give our listeners who may not be aware of your style just a taste of it. This is from season one, I believe. Here you are with Ryan Stiles, and the host, Drew Carey, is asking you to improvise on a character on Sesame Street. Let's listen.
Sesame Street. I've been stung on the bottom. Can you spell B?
You can't spell B. B's a letter.
No. There's more than one letter in B.
Well, it's odd that there's B's in this neighborhood.
Is there a method about improv that helps you sustain laughter during a scene?
Our laughter or their laughter? Because I just tend to laugh at anything anyone says. I don't stay in character.
I was thinking of the audience. But
I'm of the Harvey Korman school of performing. I laugh at everything. I mean, you know, it's all about timing, really, and playing the moments. I think if you're in the moment, you'll get more laughs. You don't even have to say something funny. You just have to say something that everyone's thinking, I think. We're all kind of on the same page there. I mean, the thing about improv is I think the audience is playing along with you, which is what makes it different than stand-up. But stand-up, you're always trying to surprise everybody every 2 seconds. But in improv, I think if you say, I've got a banjo here, they're like, play the banjo.
Mm-hmm. Now, you tape the show in front of a live audience, and that interaction is central to the success of the skits. But obviously, improv can go wrong, and it does. And we've got another clip as an example of that. We've had to massage it a little bit to make it suitable for broadcast. Here it is.
Excuse me, son. Now, I'm no palooka, but you can't come in and bring that bazooka. This is school, as you can see. I'm a principal for thee. I'm the principal. That's true, and I'm f***ing this up, man.
Do the moments on the show always feel funny to you in your mind as you're doing it, or how consciously do you ever think, oh, I'm dying here?
Oh, well, more taping. There's no time to think about anything because we're just up and down so much and running so fast that we don't really get nervous or anything like that. And then the live show, I'm never nervous at all because, like I say, I got a great team to be on. On stage is where I feel comfortable. It's off stage where I'm, you know, chancy.
But how does doing the traveling stage show, how much does that differ from the TV show? Is it really no difference at all?
Oh, no, it's quite different. I mean, first of all, it's totally interactive. We bring people out of the audience and do improv with them. We sing songs to people in the audience, bring people out of the audience and tell stories. So it's like the opposite of watching on TV. It's way more participatory. And we can be a little more, frank.
Got it.
It's not vile or anything like that. You can totally bring kids and your family, but it's just not constrained by network TV rules. So
gotcha.
We can get saucier.
Do you try to localize the humor in any way?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, Joel's from Chicago and spent a lot of time in Michigan over the years, and I played Michigan many times. So, yeah, we try to let people know that we know where we are.
You've got your hands on a lot of projects. You're a voiceover actor. You've appeared on numerous TV programs, including a recurring role on the Nickelodeon series, True Jackson VP. Do you have an ultimate project that you are just striving to land or make happen?
Oh, no, I'm always working on stuff. I mean, we're doing the podcast today, and I've done it this year. We're going to New York in November to do it. We've done it this year in London, Wales, Glasgow, Stockholm, Antwerp, San Francisco, Portland, you know. So we take the podcast around the world. That's one of my big projects. I have a book called The Smartest Book in the World that's still out and that comes out in paperback in February. And so I'm always working on something. Probably have a new album by the end of this year, we're hoping.
All right. Greg Proops, a comedian known for both his stand-up and improv work. He's possibly best known for his work on both the British and American TV versions of the show Whose Line Is It Anyway? And Greg performs tonight alongside Joel Murray, Jeff B. Davis, and Ryan Stiles at the Wharton Center here in East Lansing. It's the traveling production Who's Live Anyway? Greg, a pleasure talking with you. We look forward to your gig here in East Lansing.
Thanks so much, Mark. I really appreciate it.
And And coming up on Current State, it's an ancestor to the piano, and over the past few years it's been making a comeback. Meet the man from the Flint Institute of Music who teaches how to play this instrument on an upswing, the harpsichord. Professor Jeffrey Walker explains why he agrees with the great conductor Sir Thomas Beecham.
I think his comment went something like, the sound of a harpsichord is like the sound of two skeletons copulating on a tin roof. And the harpsichords at that time, I really can't argue the point.
That's coming up later this hour on Current State. Rodney Page there on the violin performing Satin Doll. Rodney was our guest on Live Music Friday about a month ago. And speaking of music, Blues Fest returns to Lansing's Old Town this weekend. Our Live Music Friday guest is Mary Flower, and she's in town from Portland, Oregon to perform tomorrow night at Blues Fest. Downbeat Magazine has described her as a world-class fingerstyle guitarist and lap slide player. We'll also talk with organizer Terry Terry about this year's Blues Fest. Mary Flower and Terry Terry tomorrow on Live Music Friday here on Current State. That was kind of a musical sentence there, actually. Mary Flower and Terry Terry tomorrow. We hope you can join us. That is tomorrow. I'm Mark Bayshore. It's Current State on WKAR. The East Lansing Wastewater Treatment Plant's permit to dump treated water into the Red Cedar River expired more than 4 years ago. The city applied for the renewal of the permit on time back in 2012, but the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality, the DEQ, has only just now said they're reviewing it. So why are they doing it now? How unusual is it for a permit to be expired for so long? And what does it all mean? Here to help us answer some of those questions, Alice Dreger of EastLansingInfo.org, Eli, a free independent news and information website that we've discussed on our show recently. She's the founder and board president. Welcome back, Alice.
Thanks, Mark.
The permit in question is what authorizes the water plant to dump the effluent, the treated water, into the Red Cedar. And to clarify, this does not affect drinking water, correct?
Correct. The permit relates to the Clean Water Act, and it's the idea that anybody who's dumping things into public waters needs to be sure that they're dumping clean water. Mm-hmm.
So the permit expired, and when you found out that it had not been renewed, you tried to find out why. Talk to us about what you found.
Well, I was a little shocked to discover that it had expired 4 years ago, because it doesn't seem like in any other instance you could have a public license that is this important that would simply expire and not be addressed for 4 years, particularly in a plant that had a mercury spill that was covered up and spread around the city, in a plant that's had another recent spill, in a plant that's had a lawsuit brought against it, which is actually how I found out about this stuff. And so I started making calls to the city, then to the DEQ, then to the EPA, trying to find out why it would be. And really, to be honest, I still have not gotten an answer on why it's taken 4 years. And as far as I can tell, the reason they're dealing with it now is the lawsuit and my calls. They opened the permit finally to look at it about a week after I nagged the heck out of them.
Well, Current State reached out to the DEQ to invite them to be on the show or to comment. Mike Bitondo of the DEQ Permit Office told us that there's a backlog of these kinds of permits all across the state, and they're working to try to get all caught up by next year. But he also said it's not uncommon for them to expire. What more do you know about this backlog and how the DEQ deals with it?
I've been trying to find out more about it, but it's very difficult to find out because the DEQ is sort of authorized to do this by the EPA in the state of Michigan. And if you go to the site that the EPA runs for these permits, the DEQ has not been inputting the information. And in fact, the EPA has a note on the site that basically says, if you're looking at Michigan, it may be way behind in terms of the data. And so you've got a situation where you can't even look up and see in some circumstances what the current information is on various groups that dump into the water.
And in these circumstances, I take it the municipality, in this case East Lansing, is just the
old permit is just extended?
That's what they told me, that it is extended. And when I said to them, where's the paperwork on the extension? They said there is no paperwork on the extension. They don't need any paperwork, which I found kind of amazing that you would have a major wastewater treatment plant. It doesn't just cover East Lansing. It also covers Meridian Township and MSU. So it's a significant size wastewater treatment plant dumping 12 million gallons of water treated a day into the Red Cedar River. And yet the DEQ's attitude was, oh, yeah, they applied for it and a quarter years ago, and we just haven't looked at it, but there's been no back-and-forth paperwork whatsoever. I found that pretty shocking, and I also find it pretty shocking that they're even using an application that's 4 years old. The personnel has radically changed at the plant. The plant itself has changed. The city has been making changes to the plant that are significant in the cost of millions of dollars. The numbers that are on the application are outdated and wrong at this point. And so, you know, imagine if you imagine your driver's license, right? Would the state really allow your driver's license to go 4 years expired and simply say, oh, we haven't gotten around to reminding you that your driver's license is expired. Don't worry about it. There's no paperwork on it. And by the way, we'll just use your eye test that we did 4 years ago. That's, I think, what we're looking at. And it's pretty disturbing. You know, I don't think the DEQ folks are bad folks, but they're underfunded, understaffed, and they're way behind on regulatory stuff.
We're talking with Alice Dreger of EastLansingInfo.org about the delay in re-permitting the East Lansing Water Treatment Plant to return treated water back into the Red Cedar River, and the other recent challenges that that plant has been facing, which you alluded to just a minute ago. A lot has happened here over the past 4 years. I think quite a few locals know about the mercury spill, which you alluded to, but there have been other things that have gone on too. Can you touch on a few of those?
Sure, absolutely. So a couple of weeks ago, there was a new ferric chloride acid spill, which involved 600 gallons. And
This is weeks ago.
Weeks ago.
Yeah.
And the city's not exactly even sure why the spill occurred yet, and they're not sure what it's going to cost to clean up and what it's going to involve. But basically, this type of acid that's used at the plant got into the soil all over the place, they think, because a groundwater pipe that was, not groundwater, a ground pipe that was transmitting this stuff broke. And so that's going to be another major spill cleanup. It's actually difficult to know how many other spills there have been because you have to go searching through a lot of information that's not publicly available and use the Freedom of Information Act to get information. But in addition to this, the lawsuit that's been brought against the city by plant workers alleging failure to take care of their safety includes things like, in 2007, the city hired an outside consultant to look at asbestos at the plant. And the consultant found significant amounts of asbestos, including what's called friable asbestos, the kind of asbestos that can actively harm you. It's crumbling and you could breathe it in all around the plant. And the consultant correctly recommended that they immediately put signage up, that they immediately make sure that the workers were advised of where this was and to make sure they had personal protection equipment when it was the case that they were going to be in these areas. None of that was done, as far as we can tell. I mean, I've looked through all of the records, the transcripts from the depositions in the trial. And so for 7 years, nothing happened. And it's only because of the mercury spill causing a scandal that the asbestos became known and then the lawsuit happened.
How much have you heard from City of East Lansing officials here in your travels related to this story?
They are understandably reluctant to answer a lot of my questions, and so I press pretty hard on some things, like trying to find out from them, did they reapply for the permit, what's going on with regard to this regulation or that regulation. But I have to use the Freedom of Information Act quite a lot to find out what's going on.
So back to the DEQ, they issued a public notice that they're reviewing the city's application for the permit, but the timeline here turned out to be very, very interesting. In fact, the time for public comment is about to expire, and I think it appears that a lot of people just learned that there was a public comment period. Do I have that right?
You absolutely do. The public comment period expires tomorrow, and what people can do is they can look up My Waters. It's spelled M-I for Michigan, Waters, and if you search that, you'll find a place where it says there's a public comment period open, and then search it by the county, which is Ingham, and it'll bring up the wastewater treatment plant. You can post a public comment. But the only way I even found out about that was that I was nagging them again to say, when are you going to review this permit? And they sent to me a very odd email that said, the public comment period will be opened on August 19th, but they were sending me this message on
September 9th,
which meant 3 weeks earlier the public comment period had opened. It was only sort of coincidental that I even found out, and it's not clear to me when it really was open, to be honest. So there's this incredibly tiny window on a plant that has a history of enormous amounts of issues, closing very rapidly, I suspect because they don't really want to have to deal with too much public comment on it. That would be my suspicion. Otherwise, I can't understand why, if they're serious about about wanting public comment, they wouldn't, for example, the city of East Lansing wouldn't issue a press release saying the public comment period is now open on our wastewater treatment plant. Yeah. But the city's been silent on this. Yeah.
What's been the response from the community to your reporting?
I think a lot of shock in terms of realizing, you know, the city of East Lansing is a pretty well-functioning city. And so if this is going on at the city of East Lansing, what else is happening in the state of Michigan with regard to wastewater? And then the other reaction has been, I think, one of gratitude that, you know, we're bothering to follow this stuff up. As we talked about last time I was on your show, the situation right now economically for news is that people don't want to pay for news, and that's meant that we don't have a lot of news reporting at the local level. And as a consequence, a lot of us are doing it voluntarily to try to make sure our government is functioning correctly.
Alice Dreger of EastLansingInfo.org. Eli, we've been talking about the way ahead here for the East Lansing Wastewater Treatment Plant and that permit they need to dump treated water into the Red Cedar River. Thanks for sharing what you've learned about this, Alice.
Thank you, Mark.
Did you know that in a grand piano, the strings being played are exerting about 30 tons of tension on the hundreds of strings found inside? Well, before a piano was ever manufactured, another instrument was played, an ancestor with exponentially less tension to deal with. That instrument was the harpsichord. Current State's Jamie Paisley spoke with Professor Jeffrey Walker, who still teaches how to play this ancestor to the piano at the Flint Institute of Music.
For those that aren't aware of the harpsichord, how is it different from a piano?
Well, the harpsichord is the keyboard instrument that Bach and Handel and Scarlatti and Couperin knew. It precedes the modern piano, and in the harpsichord, the strings are plucked by mechanism. There is a keyboard there, but it's a very simple mechanism that plucks the string. And then as the key returns, the tongue is on a spring so that the plectrum can slip back under the string, and a piece of felt touches the string as the damper. It's a very simple and very reliable mechanism.
As opposed to the piano, which is a hammered string, which means, I believe, that this piano is then classified as a percussion instrument because it's a hammer. What then, with the plucking action of the harpsichord, what family does that instrument reside in?
This would be a string instrument. The other difference from that action is we don't have dynamic control from note to note. We have other expressive devices, but that was really what started to evolve the piano. The early forte pianos were basically harpsichords with very small hammers because it's very lightly strung. And then one could play loud or soft, thus forte piano, loud, soft. And there are many, many stages then in between until we get to the modern grand piano. But the overall history is that as performance venues became larger, they wanted a bigger sound, heavier stringing, bigger hammers. Then in order to withstand the tension of the strings, the structure had to get bigger, and eventually we get to the modern cast iron plate that holds many, many tons of tension on the frame of the piano. Obviously, the harpsichord, being all wood, would simply fold up.
We're speaking with Professor Jeffrey Walker of the Flint Institute of Music about the harpsichord, which he has a recital coming up this Friday night at MacArthur Auditorium here in Flint. And this program that's coming up is all French Baroque, but there seems to be a revival of incorporation of harpsichord into various styles and even into contemporary compositions. Do you foray into that at all?
I have researched a lot of contemporary harpsichord repertoire and just don't find the aesthetic. I mean, for me, it just doesn't speak through this instrument. For me, the French Baroque music, that's the soul of the harpsichord. Bach is great. I love Scarlatti and all those. But for me, the French Baroque, that's the soul of the harpsichord.
Best with a light touch, as opposed to, I guess, one of the famous quotes about the harpsichord and the sound of it done by Sir Thomas Beecham, which I'm certain you know.
Oh, yes. I think his comment went something like, the sound of a harpsichord is like the sound of two skeletons copulating on a tin roof. And the harpsichords at that time, I really can't argue the point. They were very, very bright, very thin, very tinkly. And that's, I mean, they are what they are. you know, Wanda Landowska is a name that is fairly well known. I mean, she's responsible for the modern revival of the harpsichord, which had fallen into disuse. I mean, after the forte piano and Mozart, Beethoven, and then on through the Romantic period and then into the 20th century, the Steinway Grand became the measure of all things. It was her project to revive the harpsichord. Now, she had harpsichords built for her by the Pleyel Piano Company, and they were these big behemoths with 5 and 6 sets of strings, pedal mechanism to turn them on and off, and they were pretty heavily strung, and they were fairly heavily constructed because they were made by a piano manufacturer. Poulenc wrote, of course, concerto for her to play on that, and it falls flat on a historic harpsichord. It just doesn't work. It's the wrong instrument. So her great quote was, "You play Bach your way, and I'll play him his way."
We're speaking with Professor Jeffrey Walker of the Flint Institute of Music about the harpsichord, which he has a recital coming up this Friday night at MacArthur Auditorium here in Flint. And the concert is free to the public as well, right?
Yes.
Now, as you're switching between the instruments that you perform, the keyboard, the organ, and the harpsichord, obviously, keyboard and piano keyboard, is there a sense of getting back on a bike as you switch from instrument to instrument? You know, do you have to feel that? You talked about the action being a little bit different. There's no dampening that you can do on the strings. Do you have to kind of relearn every time you switch?
It does become habitual after a while, but I mean, in those situations where I have to switch from one instrument to another in a performance, I mean, there's some sort of concentration involved to just sort of regroup. Okay, I'm not playing the piano now. The touch needs to change a little bit, obviously, and there have been those concerts. I remember actually the first time I played the Flint Symphony. It was the three Respighi tone poems, and the switch between organ, piano, and celeste. So that was that took a little concentration, but it was a great evening.
What brought you into that instrument? Because it's a very unique sound of the harpsichord. What drew you to it many years ago?
And it was many years ago. I had a wonderful piano teacher growing up in suburban Philadelphia who sent her advanced students to National Music Camp in Interlochen, Michigan. And it was after ninth grade was when I went. And my piano professor, George Luchtenberg, also taught harpsichord. So that was my first harpsichord study. And that was dormant for a while because there were really no harpsichords around where I was. But when I went to Oberlin, I took up harpsichord study again as well as organ. And then my instrument I built from a Zuckerman kit. It's a French double, French style of the early 18th century. Double means two keyboards. There are three sets of strings, two at normal pitch and then another set an octave higher. And there's a mute, which places a little piece of felt against the end of the string, so it mutes the sound like a guitar or a lute.
Is it a foot action or more of like an organ pedal?
They're all hand levers on historic instruments. The foot mechanism was an invention of the early 20th century, so that you could change registrations. And some of the players then, Ralph Kirkpatrick, a little later than Wanda Landowska, comes to mind. He would actually do crescendos and diminuendos by gradually turning on a set of strings and gradually taking them off. His Scarlatti recordings are extraordinary. It's just fabulous playing, but you just kind of have to hold on a little bit with those crescendos and decrescendos that you don't expect from that sound. He eventually stopped doing that in his later years, but it was very compelling playing, so that's great.
Professor Jeffrey Walker coming up for the recital this Friday evening at 7 o'clock at the MacArthur Auditorium at the Flint Institute of Music. Thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thanks very much for having me.
For Current State, I'm Jamie Paisley.
And that's our show for today. Tomorrow on Current State, a recent nationwide study paints a very surprising portrait of how victims of crime view the criminal justice system. Lock them up and throw away the key?
The study shows that may not be the answer that victims of crime want. Plus, it's a live music Friday here on Current State. Our guest is Mary Flower, in town from Portland, Oregon, to perform at this weekend's Lansing Blues Fest. Downbeat Magazine has described her as a world-class fingerstyle guitarist and lap slide player. You'll hear her live here in Studio S on WKAR's Current State Live Music Friday. That and more tomorrow here on Current State. Our executive producer is Peter Wharf. Kevin Lavery directed the show today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Katie Cook, Jamie Paisley, Brooke Allen, and to Drew Hill. The Current State podcast, everything we do, ends up there. It also ends up at WKAR.org. Don't forget that. The Current State podcast, anywhere, anytime, on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Stay connected with Current State on Twitter. Follow us at KAR Current State. We're on Facebook at Current State from WKAR. Thank you for joining us today. I'm Mark Bayshore. See you on Live Music Friday on Current State.